You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
If you want to paint a flattering picture of Canada's past, it surely would include the image of Peacekeeper. And a face that surely would stand out in such a picture is that of Lester B. Pearson, longtime Minister of External Affairs, also a Prime Minister, and winner of the Nobel Peace Prize. Compared to the war-making rhetoric and actions of Canada's present government, it is understandable that many long for a return of the Pearson past. But according to Eve Engler, examining Pearson will be more a cold shower than a warm bath. Author and activist Eve Engler has just published a book on the role of Lester Pearson in the making of Canadian foreign policy. It's titled Lester Pearson's Peacekeeping, The Truth May Hurt. We've reached Eve Engler in Montreal. Good morning, Eve, and welcome back to Co-op Radio and Red Eye.
Thanks for having me.
Noam Chomsky wrote an introduction to your book, and he tells an anecdote that contrasts between the image and the reality of Lester Pearson's record. What's that anecdote?
Well, Chomsky refers to an interview he did in the 80s. He used to go on Morningside with Peter Zofsky on CBC, and he'd been on a handful of times, and Zofsky always wanted him to criticize U.S. foreign policy. And one time he decided he'd had enough of just criticizing U.S. foreign policy, so he decided to take aim at Canadian foreign policy. And when Zofsky asked him about arriving at in Toronto, Chomsky said he arrived at War Criminal Airport, obviously the Toronto airport being the Lester B. Pearson Airport. And then Chomsky went into, and then Zofsky, in response to Chomsky saying that, Zofsky freaked out at him and basically started yelling at him on air. So it's a kind of a funny funny anecdote about sort of a willingness among Canadian media to be critical about foreign policy, so long as it's not Canadian foreign policy, it's U.S. foreign policy, and I think being critical of Lester Pearson's foreign policy really goes at one of the myths that many sort of Canadians hold in terms of this this idea of Canada being a benevolent international actor, when any serious investigation of Pearson's record will find that that Pearson was responsible for, was complicit in, should I say, a huge amount of death and destruction, from the killing fields of Korea to Vietnam, to his role in the establishment of NATO, support for a variety of U.S. Or CIA-backed coups in Iran and Guatemala, etc.
So that kind of myth of peacekeeping and things like that, that still exists in intellectual culture in Canada. Are there commentators today who you think would be kind of similar, indignant at the assessment, say, of Pearson and the kind of sense of the nation that he helped create?
Well, yeah, I mean, first of all, the Foreign Affairs Building in Ottawa is called the Lester B. Pearson Building, so he's still the preeminent symbol of a supposedly successful Canadian foreign policy decision-maker. What I do in the introduction is actually cite a variety of people recently who have said positive things about Pearson's foreign policy, and I cite people from, like, Michael Ignatieff, which shouldn't surprise people, as he was a leader of the Liberal Party, but also people like Jack Layton, like Elizabeth May, other people among progressives, someone like Stephen Staples from the Rideau Institute, Linda McQuaig from the Toronto Star, a left-wing columnist from the Toronto Star, and even Naomi Klein. I cite them all in the introduction, making reference to a sort of positive Pearsonian foreign policy. And I've said this to a number of people recently, is that, in fact, I think that as terrible as Harper's foreign policy is, and it is, there's nothing positive to be said about it, Pearson was complicit in more death and destruction than Stephen Harper. Because if you look back at what he was complicit in with the Korean War, pushing to send 27,000 Canadian troops to Korea, the killing fields of Korea were beyond belief. Similarly, with regards to his support for Vietnam and supporting delivering U.S. bombing threats to North Vietnam, the level of human horror that Pearson sort of enabled or was, I guess, ultimately supportive of, is hard to get your head around. And that goes against so much of the story we're told, including from people who are generally relatively progressive-minded people.
So you write that Pearson became an important player in shaping Canadian foreign policy by the end of World War II, and I guess he had a big part in the Cold War in shaping Canadian perspective on the Cold War as well. What was his perspective on the Cold War?
Well, Pearson, contrary to what some people say, was actually a strong Cold Warrior. In his comment after comment he made in the House of Commons, referring to the powerful Slavic Empire of the Soviet Union, and talking about how the communists were trying to take over the world, and also he actually had all kinds of stuff about internally, especially early on, talking about how the communists were trying to take over the kindergartens in Western Europe and stuff like that. Within that, he was also, according to his own assessment, the most important thing he did was his role in the creation of NATO. So he says the most important thing he participated in was the formation of NATO, which was a body designed in part, where it was justified as to protect Western Europe and North America from possible Soviet aggression, but in fact was designed to prop up the Western European elite in the face of internal left-wing unrest, and was designed to maintain some level of Western control of the world. But he was a huge supporter of NATO, and his foreign policy was heavily structured around NATO, and repeatedly he justified Canada sending troops to Korea through the lens of NATO, even though the North Atlantic area, of course, is about as far from as Korea as anywhere in the world. He was a strong proponent of the Cold War, and all of the sort of the different proxy wars, if you like, that the U.S. justified around the world as a way to combat the supposed Soviet menace.
What was his goal in that in NATO, like in supporting NATO and pursuing that agenda?
I think what Pearson should symbolize in the history of Canadian foreign policy is the individual who did the most in terms of shifting Canada from being supportive of the British Empire to being supportive of the American Empire. And he saw earlier than many other Canadian decision makers where the world was going, and also that it was in the Canadian elite's interest to prod forward the emerging American Empire. No other country's elite were better integrated with the U.S. elite politically, culturally, and of course business-wise. And so when he was involved in establishing NATO, when he was involved in supporting the U.S. war in Korea from 1950 to 1953, a big part of what he was pushing forward was he was supportive of an expanded U.S. foreign policy, of a growing U.S. strength in the world, because he was very tied in with American Rockefellers and important American business people, and he represented the Canadian elite that saw that this was going to be in their self-interest to expand U.S. power in the world. So I think that Pearson should symbolize the individual who did the most in terms of shifting Canada towards a pro-U.S. empire foreign policy and pushed forward the U.S. empire, which in my talks about the book, I really draw out the parallels between Lester Pearson's foreign policy and Stephen Harper's foreign policy, and that's an important one. You know, today when we want to understand Stephen Harper's foreign policy, part of what we have to understand is the context that he's working within, and of a very pro-U.S. empire context, and that to a large extent was established in Canadian foreign policy. That was established with Lester Pearson in the post-World War II period.
He also had involvement in Latin America, Africa, and the Middle East. What were his policies in those areas?
Well, in terms of the Middle East, he was a very strong proponent of Zionism, and he played an important role on two different UN committee meetings dealing with the British Mandate of Palestine in 1947, and he pushed forward a policy that was very sympathetic to the Zionist movement, and it's particularly dubious on one level because he also, at the same time, or just previous to that, he'd supported not allowing post-World War II Jewish refugees into Canada, and he really pushed to have the question of post-World War II Jewish refugees dealt with alongside the question of Zionism, which is or the question of the British Mandate of Palestine, which was something that the Zionist movement very much supported. In terms of Latin America, he was quite hostile to Cuba, and before he took office as prime minister, there was a memo from the Cuban ambassador discussing just the negative development of Pearson becoming prime minister, and the Diefenbaker was had a better policy towards Cuba. He supported the U.S. invasion of the Dominican Republic in 1965. There was actually Canadian naval vessels that were sent off the coast to sort of support the U.S. role there. Also rhetorical support. Similarly, with regards to the coup in against Arbenz in 1954 in Guatemala, one issue that I think surprises a lot of people is his ambivalence towards apartheid South Africa. And when an NDP member of parliament in 1964 asked Pearson to call for Nelson Mandela's release from prison, who had just been imprisoned by the apartheid regime in South Africa, Pearson refused, and that was reflective of his ambivalence towards apartheid South Africa. And he'd actually been called a good friend of South Africa by the South African ambassador at the UN, and he'd supported maintaining special Commonwealth trade agreements between South Africa and Canada, even after South Africa was pushed out of the Commonwealth. And more generally, his position on British colonialism in Africa was one of ambivalence, and was one of criticizing those who were criticizing the British colonial rule in Africa, who were calling for a quicker independence. So many people, again, portrayed Pearson as having been anti-colonial, but in fact there was a lot of ambivalence and sometimes outright support for British colonialism in Africa.
And what about nuclear weapons and the arms race? What was his position on that?
Again, there's this sort of, some people will portray him as being against nuclear weapons, which is kind of the height of irony, since he was the person who formally brought Bomark nuclear tip missiles to Canada, and just after taking office in 1963 as prime minister. That's an issue that has got lots of attention. It's something that no one it shouldn't be possible to forget about that today. But it's within the less popularized issues that are in some ways even more striking. So in the 50s, when he was external minister, he actually called on Canadians to destroy a peace group, the Peace Congress, that had called for the abolition of nuclear weapons. So when a University of Toronto engineering students took over a U of University of Toronto Peace Congress chapter with the express purpose of undermining the organization, he actually lauded these Canadians, went to a community meeting and celebrated their actions in trying to undermine / destroy this group. So he was very much supportive of the American Empire, and of course in the immediate post-World War II period, it was the U.S., the only country that had nuclear weapons, and so flowing from there, he was generally sympathetic and supportive of nuclear weapons, so long as they were concentrated in U.S. or other Western hands.
What do you think explains the image that people have of Pearson, given sort of the facts of his foreign policies?
Well, I mean, I think the part of what explains it is sort of the lack of real critical analysis of let's call it left-wing analysis of Canadian foreign policy. I think that it's not just a question of Pearson. It's a more general question of there's this idea that Canada has been this benevolent actor. Pearson is the preeminent symbol of that, and that's my estimation very much serves power, and it serves the interests of the elite to have the majority of Canadians to assume the best of the foreign policy establishment, to assume that when there's some suffering that happens somewhere, let's take Libya as a recent example, that the Canadian government's intention will be to, you know, end the human suffering, to, you know, bring about some sort of positive change from a human perspective. It serves the Canadian elite very well to have that as the de facto assumption among most Canadians, which I believe it is the case. The most Canadians assume the best of Canadian foreign policy decision makers. It serves the elite's interest, because if you assume the best, then it makes some sort of sense to think that, you know, Canada would engage in some mission in Libya that might bring some protection of human rights. Now, if you assume the worst of Canadian foreign policy decision makers, and I think the historical record suggests that that usually Canadian foreign policy decision makers are motivated by corporate interests, by imperial interests, and not by human interests. If you assume the worst, you're much more likely to be immediately critical of Canada's engagement in a place like Libya, as an example. So to have that general assumption of a benevolent international Canadian foreign policy, that is something that is very good for the elite, and I think that's a big part of why the dominant media structures in this country just constantly bombard us with these stories of this benevolent international Canada, which again Pearson is the preeminent symbol of that.
Thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
I've been speaking with Eve Engler, author and activist. His latest book is titled Lester Pearson's Peacekeeping, The Truth May Hurt. The book has an introduction by Noam Chomsky.